Legacy Geneva Bible by looking at the Old Testament. Please recall that the Geneva Bible set forth English renderings of the Hebrew text for Ezra through Malachi for the first time. Prior to 1560, William Tyndale had translated the Pentateuch in 1530, historical books from Joshua to 2 Chronicles, and Jonah from Hebrew into English before his death in 1536. John Rogers printed all of Tyndale's Hebrew renderings for the first time in his 1537 Matthew's Bible. This, of course, means that Miles Coverdale did not translate from Hebrew into English in his 1535 Bible or the 1539 Great Bible, in which he edited Rogers' work from 1537. So the point there, again, just to review, is the Geneva Bible, in its Old Testament for the first time, has the entire Old Testament set forth, rendered directly out of Hebrew into English. Prior to this, William Tyndale had done sections and portions. He had done the Pentateuch, the Genesis through Deuteronomy, and he had done Joshua through 2 Chronicles, as well as Jonah. But then, as you know, William Tyndale was martyred before he was able to finish. And if you further recall, even in his imprisonment before he died, asking for a Hebrew Old Testament, a Hebrew dictionary, and a Hebrew lexicon, indicating that he wanted to continue translating until they finally did kill him. And so we also have already talked about that. So the significance of this Bible, the 1560 Geneva Bible, is that it is for the first time a complete Old Testament set forth from Hebrew into English. Okay? So this morning we want to continue looking at the Geneva Old Testament by considering a few more of its important features. So, point number one, and I'll try to scroll this. You know, I don't know to what degree the folks at home can actually read that, but we'll try to keep up with that nonetheless. So, the Old Testament. The Geneva translator seems to know and or anticipate that much of the English-speaking world would need help understanding the intricacies of the Hebrew text. Consequently, they commented extensively on the text in the margins of the Old Testament. Dr. David Daniel states the following regarding the Old Testament marginal notations in his book, The Bible in English, Its History and Influence. He says, quote, It is more important to note, like the misguided Bishop's Bible translators, the King James translators' denial of marginal notes removed at a stroke the essential element of understanding Hebrew, the openness to engagement, and in and out movement between literal sense and meaning, the many kinds of explanations which the Geneva annotations so constantly use. Often the best the King James workers could do was to lift the literal Hebrew phrase from the Geneva's margin into its own text. So, there's a couple things we need to understand about that quote. Okay? Number one, the reason why the King James translators did not extensively use marginal notes is because the rules set forth by the king said they can't, they could not. Remember that the king's objection to the Geneva Bible was largely on account of the marginal notes that he viewed to be as seditious and denying the issue of the divine right of kings. So one of the reasons why the king is on board with doing, I'm talking about King James here obviously, one of the reasons King James is on board with doing another translation in the first place is because the Geneva Bible was the Bible of the people, the most popular one, and he didn't like what his people were reading in the marginal notes because he viewed those notes as undermining his authority as ruling by divine right. So when the king and his Archbishop Bancroft set forth the rules, and we'll study the rules in detail when we get to the King James, when he set forth the rules of the King James translation, one of them was that there would be no marginal notes except to clarify or offer an alternative reading. That was it. So when you look at a Geneva Bible, so here's Psalms 1, for example, and you see like tons of marginal notation all around the edges of the text here for Psalms chapter 1. the King James rules given to the King James translators were to not do this type of marginal commenting because the king didn't like it. Okay, so that's the first thing we need to get from this. So be with that. The second thing, let's read the last sentence again of that. So I'm right here. Often, the best the King James workers could do was to lift the literal Hebrew phrase from the Geneva's margin into its own text. So I'm going to show you examples this morning of where the King James readings came from, the marginal notes in the Geneva Bible. So in many cases, the reading that finds its way into the King James text, so here's my King James, in many cases, the readings that find their way into the King James as the main reading in the King James text are often lifted from the marginal notes that are found where? In the Geneva Bible. Okay? So that to me, it's an important point that you understand first why there are fewer marginal notes in the King James Bible. And second, that many of the readings in the King James Bible, particularly in the Old Testament, for those sections that Tyndale's prior work was not available, the King James is moving forward with the literal rendering of the Hebrew that is found in the marginal notes of the Geneva Bible. Okay? Now, that's kind of a lot to swallow right out of the gate here. Does anybody have any questions about that?
The marginal notes, man's opinion on the meaning of that verse, or was it just a different, was it a translation from the,
so,
from the Hebrew into more of a understandable way?
Anybody see the eraser anywhere? Here it is. It's buried. So, good question, Ernie. So as I'll just touch on it now, and we'll see it demonstrated here as we get into this, okay? But they do two different things, okay? Sometimes the text, we're talking about the Geneva Bible here, right? Sometimes the text had the literal Hebrew rendering, and the margin explained it in English. Does that make sense? So sometimes the text, the 1560 text, would have the literal Hebrew rendering in the main text, and they would use the margin to explain it in case there was some ambiguity that might be there for the English reader. But then other times, they would do the opposite. The text would have, like, the English equivalent, and that in the margin, they would give the literal Hebrew. Does that make sense? So sometimes they're using the margin to explain the Hebrew idiom that they actually put in the text. Sometimes they do it a little bit more loose in English, and then they use the margin to explain the literal Hebrew idiom. Okay, so they do it both ways, as we're going to see in this, right? So sometimes the King James translators just follow or use what is the literal text of the Geneva Bible, and sometimes I'll show you examples of this where they lift the literal Hebrew rendering out of the margin and put it in the King James as the main King James text. Does that make sense? Okay, any other questions? Okay, hopefully we're not too confused, only 7 minutes in, that'd be bad, all right? So, according to Dr. Daniel, and I forgot to bring Hammond's book, I should have brought it, Gerald Hammond's 50 pages of examination of the Geneva translators at work with Hebrew remain the best introduction to the subject. So, I have that book. That book is out of print and hard to get, Sylvia. How much did you pay
for it? $14.
How much was it on Amazon?
I didn't even check.
You got one for $14?
On eBay. Used.
Is it the 1982 British printing or the 1983 American printing.
I don't know. Does that look like the cover?
That's the cover I have, yeah. Okay. Anyway, this guy's work, this Gerald Hammond's work on the Geneva Bible is absolutely fascinating to read this stuff and what he was able to collate and put together. Professor Daniel is, of course, referring to Gerald Hammond's groundbreaking 1982 publication, The Making of the English Bible. It is to the work of Hammond that we will now turn our attention. Hammond's discussion of the Geneva Bible is long and detailed, spanning 50 pages of text. On page 94, Hammond begins a discussion of how the Geneva Bible handled the translation of Hebrew words and phrases into English. The topic was addressed by the translators in the preface to the Geneva Bible. So now we go to page 2, and we have a fairly long quote here from Hammond. All right. The preface to the Bible, so that's this Bible right here, this 1560 Geneva Bible. The preface to the Bible makes the purpose of one kind of note very clear. It speaks of the translator's attempts to keep the Hebrew phrase, notwithstanding that they may seem somewhat hard in the ears, that are not well practiced, and also delight in the sweet sound phrases of the Holy Scriptures. Those who are not well practiced clearly meant the majority of the people. The Geneva Bible was to be the first readily accessible Bible produced in England. For those people, either, quote, the simple, who may be easily dismayed by the unfamiliarity of the Hebrew phrase, or the malicious, who might use it as a stick to beat the translation with, we have in the margin noted that diversity of speech or reading, which may also seem agreeable to the mind of the Holy Ghost and proper for our language. So, let's stop there. What are they saying there? They're saying, and are they acknowledging, that the Hebrew might sound a little weird to an English reader? Now, you need to understand something. You and I are familiar with it. So it doesn't sound weird to us. You and I are familiar with it because we've been reading it for most of our adult lives in a King James Bible. Okay? But if you go, and this is hard for people to do, this is what historians call contextualization. In other words, trying to put yourself back into the context. If you're sitting there as an English-speaking person in 1560 and you pick this up for the first time and start reading it, are you going to encounter Hebrew words and phrases that are going to sound strange to you as an English reader of this? You probably are, right? So what they are saying here in the preface, what they're saying is that they use the margin to help explain to the reader things that might sound strange or awkward to them as they're taken out of Hebrew and put into what? English, okay? You guys with that? You following what I'm saying there? Okay? The preface goes on to describe other things in the notes and texts which are for the reader's aid. Those places where it is almost impossible to keep the Hebrew phrase have also a literal translation of the Hebrew in the margin, and wherever interpolation has had to be made, they are signaled by italicization. So in other words, that's the spots where English words are inserted into the text to complete what? To complete the thought. Does the King James Bible do that too?
Yes.
The Geneva Bible was the first Bible to do that. We talked about that already when we looked at the 1557 New Testament. Okay? So, the simplest of the marginal notes, those with no other explanation, give the literal meaning of the Hebrew or Greek original. We do not have to go very far into the Bible to see the preface's claim is a little disingenuous. So, the preface says one thing, but then they kind of go back and forth between it. It's not as hard and fast a rule as what they would make you think when you read the preface. Now, I'm not saying that they literally lied in the preface. I'm just saying that when they applied the principle, they did it two different ways, and it could get a little confusing, okay? Okay, so we do not need to go very far in the Bible to see the preface's claim is a little disingenuous. From there, we might well have assumed the Hebrew phrase was everywhere retained except when the English translation simply could not contain it. But it soon becomes clear that the margin is being used to convey the literal meaning of phrases which could early have been absorbed into the body of the translation. Genesis chapter 1, verse 20, the text reads. So find Genesis 1:20 in your Bible. Okay? I think it's important that we can, you know, do this. So in your notes, it has it from the Geneva. Okay? So find Genesis 1:20 in your Bible. And I'll put it up here on the screen. So, Genesis 1:20 in the Geneva Bible says, afterward, God said, let's see here. So, yours just says, and God what? God said, right? Afterward, God said, let the waters bring forth in abundance every creeping thing that hath life, and let the fowl fly upon the earth in the open firmament of the heaven. Okay, so your King James says, and God said, let the waters bring forth abundantly, and the moving creature that hath life, and the fowl, sorry, I have a wrinkle in my page, and fowl that fly above it, above the earth, in the open firmament of heaven. Okay? So, in the notes on page 2 under the verse, both life and open firmament are signaled, and in the margin we find their literal meanings respectively, the soul of life and the face of the firmament. Neither of these seem to be a particularly obscure phrase or one which could not fit into the Geneva's rendering. So let me just show you what they're talking about here. So here we have the Geneva Bible. And we need to find Genesis chapter 1, and what verse was that again?
20.
So, here is Genesis chapter 1, verse 20. Afterward God said, let the waters bring forth in abundance every creeping thing that hath life, and let the fowl fly upon the earth. So you asked me about the ampersand last week. There it is right there in the text. The and sign, it's right there in the text, okay? In the open firmament of heaven. Now notice you have these little squigglies here. The little squigglies are designed to tell you that there's a note on this where?
Margin.
In the margin, okay? And if you look in the margin, and it's hard to even identify it, but you'll see it right here, Hebrew, the fowl, the soul of life, and Hebrew, the face of the firmament. So, and if you correlate those back to the text, this is them giving you the literal Hebrew equivalent where?
In the margin.
You guys following that? So, bottom of page 2. These marginal alternative readings give an invaluable insight into the translation policies of the Geneva translators. At one extreme, we can sense the relinquished possibility of a truly literal translation. While the majority of the notes give the more Hebrew form, a significant minority do the opposite. The notes give the natural English version or explanation or Hebraic phrase in the text. In Genesis 6:13, for example, the Geneva text says, let's go turn to Genesis 6:13. And I want to bring it up here too. So here it is at the top of the page, Genesis 6:13. Okay, so let's read that. In Genesis 6:13, for example, the text has God saying to Noah, an end of all flesh is come before me. So let's read the verse. And God said unto Noah, an end of all flesh is come before me. What does yours say for that phrase? The end. But I think that's the only difference, right? Between the King James and the Geneva. Okay? So, here's what I want you to see. And God said unto Noah, an end of all flesh is come before me, for the earth is filled with cruelty through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. So that there's a few more differences if you read further into the verse. But what we're after is this part right here, right? So the text says, an end of all flesh has come before me, right? The note in the margin explains the statement. So here's the note in the margin. And it says, or I will destroy mankind. So here they're explaining, the margin is being used to explain what's being said in English, right? In English it says, an end of all flesh has come before me. And here they're saying, well, here's what that means. Or, I will destroy mankind. It is a curiously flat alternative, generally unnecessary, because the literal rendering of the Hebrew in the body of the Geneva text can hardly be misunderstood. I mean, does everybody know what they mean? An end of all flesh has come before me. Do we need them to tell us, or I will destroy mankind? Maybe you do, maybe you don't, right? Hammond seems to think that maybe that's not entirely necessary, but I can see where, if I'm an English person in 1560 picking this up for the first time and this marginal notice here, does this possibly help me understand what that phrase means? Because the expression, an end of all flesh has come before me, that's a basically literal rendering of the Hebrew there. Notice it again. An end of all flesh has come before me. How many times do we see this construction in the Bible? This King of Kings, Lord of Lords, lilies of the field. Those expressions that you're familiar with, the reason they're that way in English is because that's the way they are where? In Hebrew, right? So in this example, what the Geneva translators did is they provided a marginal note to explain to the reader what that Hebrew idiom meant. Okay? Any questions about that? So, I want to be clear about something. I'm not saying that all of this is good or bad, right or wrong. I'm not necessarily trying to make value judgments on all this stuff. What I want you guys to understand, and the people watching this, either now at home or after the fact, is what they did. Understand what they did and how they were doing it and why they were doing it the way they did it. Does that make sense? Let's look at another one. In Genesis 16:6, so I'm at the very bottom of page 2 now, going over to page 3. In Genesis 16:6, Abram tells his wife that she has control over her hand, over her maidservant. Geneva gives the Hebrew idiom literally. Okay, so let me find that here. Just give me a minute. I need to find chapter 16. Eventually, we're going to get too far into the Old Testament for me to find these fast. So that's why I want to show these to you at the beginning. What verse is this? 16? 6. Alright, so here is 16:6. Right here. Okay, let's read it. And Abram said unto Sarah, behold, thy maid is in thine hand. Do with her as it pleaseth thee. Then Sarah dealt roughly with her, wherefore she fled from her. Okay, so let's compare that to the King James. I don't have my Bible open there because I was doing this, but what did it, somebody read it in the King James.
But Abram said unto Sarai, behold, thy maid is in thy hand, do to her as it pleaseth thee. And when Sarai dealt hurriedly with her, she fled from her face.
So there's not a lot of difference there, right? But notice that the Hebrew idiom is the same. Behold, thy maid is in thy what? Hand, right? So that's the part we're talking about, okay? So the Geneva text gives the Hebrew idiom literally. Okay, so let's look at the notes. Geneva gives the Hebrew idiom literally. Behold, thy maid is in thine hand. And at least, and lest there be any misunderstanding, adds the note. Now here's the note. Look at the note. Or power. So what are they saying? They're saying that Sarah had power over who? Her handmaid, right? her maidservant. So here's the Hebrew, behold, thy maid is in thy hand. They're anticipating that somebody's going to scratch their head and say, what? So they add the note to indicate that this is talking about Sarah having power over, ultimately over who? Her handmaid, Hagar. Okay? Let's go back to the notes. And lest there be any misunderstanding, adds a note or power to explain that Hagar is literally not in Sarah's hands at the moment. Right? I mean, if you read this phrase, behold, thy maid is in thy hand, I mean, is Sarah like standing there with her hand around Hagar's neck while that's being said? Or is that a figure of speech, is that a Hebrew figure of speech to denote the fact that Sarah had power over who? Hagar. Okay? In Genesis 31:40, so let's try to find that. The other problem with these old Bibles, guys, is that they're all Roman numerals on the chapters. So if you can't read Roman numerals, you got no prayer of finding anything. So let me stop talking and see if I can find it. There's 25. What are we looking for? 31. And what verse in 31? What's that, Mike?
40.
There's 30, so we want 31, verse 40. Is it 40? Yeah. Okay. So we're talking right down here. Genesis. Did I say Exodus? I meant Genesis. So Genesis 31:40, that's this verse right here. So let's read it first. You guys compare it with me as we read it. Genesis 31:40. I was in the day consumed with heat and with frost in the night, and my sleep departed from mine eyes. How similar is that in the King James? I'm feeling like you guys are lost and I told you something wrong.
No, it says drought instead of heat.
What's that? It says drought instead of heat? Okay. So let's go back to the notes. In Genesis 31:40, Jacob is in full rhetorical cry in his protest to Laban about the way he has been treated. And to emphasize the rhetoric, the Geneva Bible gives his comments literally. I was in the day consumed with heat and with frost in the night, and my sleep departed from mine eyes. The note to the final part of the verse reads, or I slept not. Again, the only reason for its presence is to help make more acceptable the alien phraseology of the text. It adds nothing to the meaning, nor does it make anything clearer. So here's what they're talking about, right? This part right here, or I slept not. So this might sound weird to an English person in 1560. I was in the day consumed with heat and with frost in the night, and my sleep departed from mine eyes. And then the note says, or I slept not. So in other words, the meaning of this literal Hebrew, sleep departed from mine eyes, is to say that he didn't what?
Sleep.
Okay? Any questions about that? So again, you have to, a lot of this stuff for us, in the 21st century, having grown up or having read the King James Bible as adults, for our whole life, we read this stuff and we don't struggle with it too much, right? Because we're familiar with it and this is the language of the scripture to us because we've read the King James for a long time. But if you are in 1560 and your first exposure to this is largely coming, they feel that they need to do these things to, you know, help folks understand what's going on. So, any questions or comments before we move on?
I disagree with Adam on this. I think it does add something to the meaning. I mean, sleep departed from mine eyes, that's a little bit vague.
I would say it's more, this is poetic.
Right.
Because what is Laban doing in this context? Laban is like, he's waxing eloquent in his the expression of his frustration with Laban over how he's been what? How he's been treated, right? And so this is the way the text actually reads in Hebrew. So I think it definitely clarifies it for an English reader who might not really know that phraseology. Mike,
it does clarify it a little bit.
Yeah, I think it does. And, you know, that's the problem that a lot of people then ultimately have with marginal notes at all, right? Like, none of the marginal notes in any Bible are inspired, right? The only thing that's inspired is what? The text. So none of this stuff is all like extra aid to try to help somebody understand what's going on. So, you know, we have the same thing. I mean, I have a Scofield Reference Bible here, and he's got notes and a center column with cross references, and he's got all this stuff in here that, you know, isn't necessarily part of the what? The text of Scripture, okay? So, let's continue then on page 3. Later in the chapter, Hammond notes occurrences of the opposite phenomenon, where the margin is used by the Geneva translators to carry the Hebrew idiom. So, Ernie, let's go back to your question earlier, right? So both things are happening here, in that sometimes they give, like in the examples we just looked at, they gave the literal Hebrew where? In the text, and they used the margin to try to what? Explain it. And now we're going to look at examples where they use where they put like the English equivalents in the text, and they use the margin to give the literal what? The literal Hebrew, okay? So, and this thing's going blue again on me. Whatever. Don't show me this again. So later in the chapter, Hammond notes occurrences of the opposite phenomenon where the margin is used by the Geneva translators to carry the Hebrew idiom. Most telling is where the Geneva translators use the margin to carry Hebrew idioms while their text contains an English equivalent. For this is a practice directly contrary to the preface claim to have reserved the Hebrew phrases. In Genesis 16:5, they have Sarah complaining to Abraham. So let's find that. Let's find Genesis 16:5. So go back a little bit. And again, eventually we're going to get too far into the Old Testament, and it's not going to be easy for me to find these. So I want to show these to you when they're more readily available. So what are we looking for? 16:5? Okay. So we're looking at this verse right here. All right. So in the notes. In Genesis 16:5, they have Sarah complaining to Abraham, "Thou dost me wrong." But the Hebrew idiom literally means, as the note expresses it, "My injury is upon me." So let's read the verse. So I'm going to read this. You guys follow along in the King James. So we're at Genesis 16, verse 5, right? "Then Sarah said to Abram, Thou doest me wrong. I have given my maid into thy bosom, and she seeketh that, and she seeketh that, she, and it's hard to read. And she seeketh that she hath conceived, and I am despised in her eyes. Lord, judge between me and thee." So I don't know what this one is here. Okay? So let's talk about the comparison. How does that compare with the King James? We're in 16:5, right? And Sarah said unto Abram, "My wrong be upon thee." So, "Thou doest me wrong," is what Geneva had. "I have given my maid into thy bosom, and when she saw that she conceived, I was despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between me and thee." So, some minor differences, but nothing too significant, right? Now, here's what I want you to see, okay? So let's go back to the notes. So in the notes, it says, in Genesis 16:5, they have Sarah complaining to Abram, "Thou doest me wrong." But the Hebrew idiom literally means, as the notes express, my injury is upon thee. So let's look at it. So here's verse 5. Here's this, right? If you come over here, Hebrew, my injury is upon who? Thee. Now look what the King James did in verse 5. And Sarah said, my wrong be upon who? So the King James, in the main text, is it giving the Hebrew idiom with a slight alteration. So here's an example of where the King James reading largely got its reading from where? The margin of what Bible? The Geneva Bible. You guys following that? Because you know you have to have the thinking caps on today, okay? Where are we at here? The Authorized Version has "my wrong be upon thee." So again, it's almost the same as what is in the margin. Let's go to Genesis 24 now. Let's go to Genesis 24 and look at verse 1. Okay, that's 20. We need 24. And what verse? 1? Okay, so we're talking about this verse right here in the bottom of the page. So chapter 24, notice how they do the Roman numerals? That's not even how we do them anymore. So that's what I'm saying, like, when you're reading this stuff, you like really have to concentrate, because otherwise you're not going to find it. You got to know Roman numerals. Not only know Roman numerals of how we use Roman numerals today, but like how they use Roman numerals like, you know, 500 years ago. So you gotta like figure all this stuff out to find stuff. But, which is why you can see now eventually, like when we get into Job or something, I'm gonna have to zip through a whole bunch of stuff just to find it, right? So let's look at this one. Genesis 24. So let's look at the notes. In Genesis 24:1, the Geneva text makes a significant alteration to Tyndale's rendering. Here, Abraham is described as, in Tyndale's words, old and exact with days to with
old and stricken in days.
I did. Old and stricken in days, sorry. The Hebrew phrase, whose literal meaning the Geneva note gets exact, come into days. But the Geneva's text has old and stricken in years. Okay, so let's look at that. Now, Abraham was old and stricken in years, and the Lord had blessed, right? So what does the King James have there?
Old and well stricken in age.
Old and well stricken in age, right? So here's the note. The Hebrew, come into days. So that's the literal Hebrew idiom, right? So this is, in English, they have, now Abraham was old and stricken in years. The King James says what again? And Abraham was old and well stricken in age. So, I mean, you look at some of this stuff and you see how they're trying to convey in English what the text is saying where? In Hebrew, right? But here's what it literally means in Hebrew, come into days, in the margin. So, the Hebrew phrase is whose literal meaning the Geneva note gets exact with come into days. But Geneva's text has old and stricken in years. In each of the verses 27 and 28 in Genesis 25, there's an example of literalism being left in the marginal notes. Let's go to 25, chapter 25. Now, just imagine being Hammond sitting here figuring all this out. I am happy to have his book where he can just direct me to what to look at and I can see if he's telling the truth. All right, what am I looking for? Chapter 5, 25, right? Verse what?
27
and 28. So, let's look at 27. So we're talking about this part right here. This is Genesis 25, 27, and 28. So, let's read that in the Geneva. And the boys grew, and Esau was a cunning hunter and lived in the fields. But Jacob was a plain man and dwelt in tents. And Isaac loved Esau, for venison was his meat, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Okay? So that's what's in there, how that's translated there. So I just read that to you. Now, let's look at this underneath the quote. For lived in fields, the note gives the literal sense. So let's find, so this part right here, lived in fields. Notice what the Hebrew is. A man of the what?
Fields.
What does the King James have?
A man of the field.
A man of the field, right? So, where is the King James potentially getting that reading from?
Margin.
The margin of what?
Geneva.
The Geneva. Okay, let's read on in the notes. So, for lived in the fields, the note gives a little sense of man in the field, and for venison is his meat. The margin has venison in his mouth. Okay. So this part right here, and Isaac loved Esau, for venison was his meat. Right here, venison in his mouth. What does the King James have?
Because he did eat of his venison.
Because he did eat of his venison, okay? Obviously a different rendering there. The second of these is a more understandable preference, for the literal Hebrew would seem strange to the English reader, but it's difficult to see why the translators felt that man of the field was not clear enough. This is how the Authorized Version translates the verses. And the boys grew, and Esau was a cunning hunter, a man of the field, and Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents. And Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison, but Rebekah loved Jacob. This kind of contrast between the Geneva Bible and the Authorized Version is a crucial one. Merely because it is called the Geneva Bible and hence has its roots in Calvinism, there's a tendency to think of it as the most fundamentalist of the English versions, as if it incorporates for the first time the Puritans' obsession for the literal Word of God. Its preface, too, only reinforces such an impression, but this is not the case. Time after time, it is possible to see the Authorized Version moving the literal Hebrew phrase from the Geneva's margin into its own what? Text. 1 Samuel chapter 23, verse 16. Now, we got another example here. 1 Samuel chapter 23, verse 16, the Geneva Bible says, so let's find that in your King James. 1 Samuel 23. So now we skip from Genesis to 1 Samuel. So unless you want me to spend a bunch of time trying to find it in this PDF, I'm just going to forego that right now. But I think you guys get the point at this point, right? So 1 Samuel chapter 23, verse 16, the Geneva Bible says, "And Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David into the wood and comforted him in God." The note to him is Hebrew, his hand. Giving a more accurate rendering of the verb, its principal sense is strengthen and not the comfort. The Authorized Version gets the literal Hebrew idiom, hand and all, into its rendering, quote, "and strengthen his hand in God." So in other words, who's more closely following the literal Hebrew, the Geneva or the King James? No, the King James is. Okay. A little later in the chapter, there is a more subtle change. In verse 22, Saul's order is meant is meant to search for David. The Geneva's words are, quote, to know and see his place where he haunteth. But the Hebrew says something quite different, as the Geneva notes, to haunteth makes clear, where his foot hath been. Okay? The Authorized Version is a little more literal, except that it turns Geneva's verb into a noun, thereby reproducing the grammar of the original, know and see his place where his haunt is. A haunt is a translation of a word meaning foot or footprint. Is suddenly not so radical a departure from the original as was the verb haunted. So there's a lot of technical stuff in there. All that is essentially saying is, who is more literal to the Hebrew, the Geneva or the King James? The King James. Okay? So, is the King James in many ways, therefore, an improvement on the Geneva? I would say the argument is absolutely what? Yes. So, let's just finish this paragraph. Or did we do that? We already did that. Let's 1 Samuel chapter 24, verse 4. The Geneva text has Saul going to... This one's kind of interesting. Let me see if I can... He's going to do his easement. What do you think that means? It's going to take too long to find it, so we'll just look at it in the notes. 1 Samuel 24, 4, the Geneva text has Saul going to do his easement, but the Hebrew says, as the Geneva note has it, to cover his feet, i.e. to urinate. And the literal idiom goes straight from the Geneva's margin into the Authorized Version's text. This is not a matter of Geneva's greater delicacy. So in other words, it's not like they're worried about, you know, not offending anybody. Okay? Just as its fear that the literal sense will not be understood. It is not loath later in 1 Samuel chapter 25 verse 22 to translate literally, for truly I will not leave of all that he hath by drawing of the day any that pisseth against the wall. So is the Geneva Bible perfectly fine with using the word pisseth? Apparently they are. Okay, apparently they are, right? So it's not the reason why they didn't use the literal in the previous verse in chapter 24 verse 4 isn't because they're being, you know, trying to, you know, sanitize it down and not be too extreme in their language. It's because they don't think that the people are going to understand the literal what? The literal Hebrew. So what is 1 Samuel? Let's look at 1 Samuel 24 4 in the King James. Well, that's chapter 20. Go chapter 25, verse 22. It changed the examples. If you go to 1 Samuel 25, 22, so and more also God unto the enemies of David, if I leave all that pertain to him by the morning light, any that pisseth against the wall. Okay? Now, so obviously you guys are not following that, so let me explain. Let's look at 1 Samuel 24, verse 4. 1 Samuel 24, verse 4. And the men of David said unto him, behold, the day of which the Lord said unto me, behold, I will deliver thine enemy into thine hand, that thou mayest do to him as it shall be good unto thee. Then David arose and cut off the skirt of... It is the wrong reference. No wonder everyone's looking at me like I'm speaking another language. So I'll have to fix that and find the right reference. But the point is, that is lost because of my lack of typing ability. Is it 25:4? No. Is that the King James is once again in this verse basically giving in its text the literal Hebrew found in the margin of what?
24:3.
Let's look at that. And he came to the sheepcotes by the way, where was a cave, and Saul went in to cover his feet. And David and his men remained in the sides of the cave. Okay, that's all right. So we need to fix that. So let's do this example again here, okay? So everybody go back to that paragraph. It should say in 1 Samuel 24:3, the Geneva text has Saul going in to do his easement. That's what it says. But the Hebrews, that should say, but the Hebrew says, as Geneva's note has it, to cover his feet, i.e. to urinate. And the literal idiom goes straight from the Geneva's margin into the authorized version's what? That's a lot better. Okay? So when you look at the King James text, and it says there in verse 24, to cover his feet, where did that reading come from?
The literal Hebrew.
The literal Hebrew found where?
In the Geneva Bible.
In the margin to the Geneva Bible. And that's 1 Samuel what? 24:3. And it's right here. Yeah, I know. It went dark. Go ahead, Mike. What?
I have a footnote in the Bible, and I have a footnote about to cover his feet, and it says this expression means to take a nap. It is customary in a hot climate to rest in a shaded place for a couple of hours in the middle of the day.
I don't think that's right.
I don't think that's right either. I'm looking.
Did you really go into a cave to urinate?
Well, they're all in the cave together. If you read what it says in Saul. Look at 1 Samuel 24:3. And Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of Israel and went to seek David and his men upon the rocks of the wild goats. And he came to the sheepcotes by the way, where was a cave, and Saul went in to cover his feet, and David and his men remained in the sides of the cave. So Saul's going, look it, I'm just gonna be 21st century, you know, colloquial language. He's going in there to take a leak. He's got to pee. He goes in there to pee. And who's hiding in the same cave he's peeing in?
David
and his dudes are.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, isn't that the way guys do it?
Yeah.
Nah, I'll be back in a minute.
Right.
Wander off and do your business, and then you what? You come back, right? Anyway, we're getting off the rails here, so we should probably stop. But the point of this is the following, right? The King James, and I really want to try to find this. I want you to see that the King James text, so what am I looking for, 1 Samuel 24? Man, I got everyone in an uproar now talking about urinating. Yeah, they did. I apologize. This is not to, you know. So I'm looking for 1 Samuel, right?
I think so. That's where we were. Yeah.
1 Samuel, what chapter?
24.
There's 15. This will be the last thing we do, and we'll quit. Is there a page missing?
We were at 28.
Oh, you're right. This page is missing in this. Yeah, that's 26. This should be 20. 25. No, that's 15.
Yeah.
So this page is missing.
No, we didn't go far enough. We didn't get two X's.
It's a good thing we have some Roman numeral experts. There's 23. All right, 24. What verse?
Three.
No, verse 4. And he came to the sheep coats, by the way, where there was a cave, and Saul went in to do his easement, and David and his men sat in the inward parts of what?
The cave,
right? And then there's a marginal note here to cover his feet. What's the King James text say? To cover his what? To cover his feet. Where did the King James reading come from? The marginal note of the Geneva Bible.
Cover his feet in King James is in 3.
That's how you got mixed up, Brian, because that 4 there is 3 in our.
So that's, yeah, so that's probably just difference in where you're going to start the verse. So we're, and that does highlight a potential problem, by the way, of verse numbering. Is the verse numbering inspired?
No.
So there's a confusion there. I will, and that's why he has 4 here, because the Geneva had. So this is really not a typo. When Hammond says verse 4, it is verse 4 where? In the Geneva Bible. It's part of verse 3, though, in the King James. Okay? Man, that last example was brutal. Okay? Sorry about the potty language there, okay? But the King James does, you know, the Bible does say what it says, right? I mean, so here's the point. There's a couple points here that I want you to lose sight of, and that's the following, right? So where's the King James getting this reading from? The margin, right? So the Geneva is doing it both ways. Sometimes they give you the literal Hebrew in the text, and they give you the explanation where? In the margin. Sometimes they give you a more English rendering, and they give you the literal Hebrew idiom where? In the margin. Okay? So we are at time. Here's what we'll do. Like, as you can see, I mean, I still have a bunch of pages here, and these pages get into a lot of other kinds of examples. So I am off school this week. So what I'm going to say is, let's just leave off here on page 4, and we'll look at I want to look at a few of the other categories of examples here before we move on from this. So we'll have kind of a part 2 of this next week. Okay. So don't lose these notes. We'll continue with this next time. All right. So I'm going to turn the camera off and start packing up. If you have a question or something that you want to ask me while we pack up, feel free to do that. But other than that, we'll continue with this next time.